calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot going on this week. Amazing. In all probability, on Wednesday night, George W. Bush is going to be saying, we need to send more troops. Yeah. Back on June 28th, 2005, that's 18 months ago, he was saying, well, actually, we'll just let him say it in his own words here, George W. Bush.
Sending more Americans would undermine our strategy of encouraging Iraqis to take the lead in this fight.
Yeah, it's not very loud. We'll try and crank it up here a little bit and see if we can hear this thing, because it's one of those recorded from some reporter's mic. Here he is.
Sending more Americans would undermine our strategy of encouraging Iraqis to take the lead in this fight. And sending more Americans would suggest that we intend to stay forever, when we are in fact working for the day when Iraq can defend itself and we can leave.
Yeah, so then he said, don't send more troops. And, of course, most of his generals are now saying, all right, George, you know, we should have had more troops back in May of 2002, but you blew it. You blew this thing. You won the war. You lost the occupation. It's time for a political solution. There is no military solution. It's only a political solution. And I've got to tell you, there is a possibility that this is going to work out. But it's going to work out not because of the way most Americans think it's going to work out. There's an incredible bit of strategy here that the Bush administration is doing. And do not be fooled by this. I mean, this is a magic trick of the first order. You know, in classical magic tricks, when I was a kid, when I was 12 years old, my best friend, Chuck Harrington, his dad was a magician. I mean, a professional magician, the Lansing Guild of Magicians, ring number 54. And Chuck and I learned magic from Chuck's dad and got pretty good at it, actually. In fact, we were on the Bozo Show, Channel 6 in Lansing, as magicians. And we'd do kids' parties and things. I was 12 years old. And Chuck was also a ham radio operator. That's right. He was my mentor in ham radio. He's an old and dear friend. I haven't seen Chuck in probably 30 years, but I hope he's out there and he's doing well. And in any case, what you learn when you're an amateur magician, or a professional magician for that matter, is that if you're doing the real trick with your left hand, you want everybody to be looking at your right hand. So if the real trick is, you know, flipping the little lever to release the bunny or whatever, you want your right hand to be waving a silk around so everybody's looking at your right hand. They're not seeing what you're doing with your left hand. And that's what Bush is going to be doing coming up soon, in my opinion. And we'll see how this plays out. But this all has to do with the Marshall Plan. And again, you heard it first here, because I'm not hearing any commentators out there talking about this. Now, hopefully, by my talking about it on this program, somebody will pick it up. Some of these folks will pick it up. But this is what I see coming down the road, is the way to tamp down, or the way to stop the insurgency, the way to dramatically reduce the violence. I mean, we're talking about thousands of people a month in Iraq dying, right? 17,310 Iraqi civilians and police officers died violently in the last half of 2006. The way to tamp that down is to reduce unemployment. Unemployment in Iraq is running between 50 and 60%. If you can get unemployment in Iraq down to 5, 10, 15%. If you can get people to work, you're not going to have an insurgency. You're going to have people working, because at the bottom of the end of the day, the bottom line here, or the cliche of your choice, is that people would rather work than fight. It's just, I mean, you know, welcome to human nature 101. And Harry Truman knew this, and George Marshall knew this, and so when they put together the Marshall Plan, they went into Europe and they said, we're going to give you some money, we're going to loan you some money, and you hire local German companies and local French companies and local Belgian companies, but principally Germany. You hire local companies, and they will hire your local people, and you will put your own country back to work using our money. And lo and behold, it worked. And for 60 years, and plus they said, and by the way, we strongly encourage you to do the things that Harry Truman tried to do here in the United States. In 1947, he proposed to Congress a single-payer national health care system, Medicare for all. It was shot down by the Republicans in the House and Senate. In 1935, Franklin Roosevelt passed strong labor protections. Essentially, if a majority of people in a workplace wanted to be members of a union, you had a union and you had to join. That was the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act of 1935. And again, in 1947, first year the Republicans took control of the House and Senate, they rolled that back to a certain extent by passing Taft-Hartley. So here's Harry Truman in 47, not getting his national health care program, watching the protection of labor being eroded. So he says to the Germans, you ought to try, you know, I had a good idea, and I think it'd work good for you. It would work well for you. And the Germans said, cool, we'll do that. And for 60 years, conservatives have been bloviating. They've been hysterical. They've been going on and on and on. Oh, it was just a fluke. It was just an accident. It was just a trick of nature. It was the fact that Germans are hard workers. That's why the German economy bounced back. Had nothing to do with the Marshall Plan. Had nothing to do with giving the German government and German companies money so that they could hire people and put them back to work. And we'll prove it to you. And they tried in Iraq. They were so certain that their program of going into Iraq and simply throwing the country open to any for-profit corporation in the world, particularly American ones that wanted to go in and run things, would be such a marvelous economic success that they didn't even have a plan B. I mean, they literally didn't even have a plan B. And their strategy didn't work. Their anti-Marshall Plan didn't work. You know, bringing in Halliburton and Bechtel and Blackwater and all these other companies, it didn't work. And so you've got the largest construction project in all of Iraq going on in the green zone. It's 108 acres, 21 buildings. It's going to house thousands of people. Huge project, not a single Iraqi working on it. You've got Iraqi unemployment running around 60%. So my prediction, and we'll see. I mean, we'll find out a month or two down the road if I'm right or not. But my prediction is that what is really going to happen is that the Bush administration is going to embrace the Marshall Plan. They're going to ask for $1 billion, which is an enormous amount of money in Iraq, where a good salary is $550 a year. They're going to ask for $1 billion, and they're going to hand that money off to the Maliki government, and they're going to say, put people back to work. Those 200 state-owned industries that we said privatize those things, and 180 some of them are still shut down because nobody wanted to buy them. You know, just put them back online. Start making cement again. Start building buildings. Hire Iraqi contractors. Do it the way that Harry Truman did and George Marshall did in Europe in the 1940s, late 1940s, early 1950s. And start rebuilding the country. The unemployment rate in Iraq will start going down. The insurgency will decrease. At the same time, Bush will put 10, 20, 30,000 more soldiers on the ground. That will have some helpful effect if it's done right. They're also talking about bringing in the Peshmerga, the Kurdish fighters, you know, the Kurdish forces from the north who don't have a dog in the fight between the Sunnis and the Shia. They just really want their own independent Kurdistan. They're talking about bringing Kurdish soldiers in and having them help patrol Baghdad to try to stop the sectarian violence. If it's done right, it might actually have some positive effect. But the major effect is going to be putting people back to work. And so what is going to happen, in my opinion, and again, we'll see. I may well be wrong on this. This is totally cynical perspective. I'll tell you that right up front. But in my opinion, what's going to happen is with his left hand, Bush is going to be doing the real magic trick, which is they're going to do a Marshall Plan without admitting it. Bechtel has already announced they're pulling out of the country. Other countries, other big contractors are leaving. They're just going to give the money to the Iraqis and say, you guys rebuild your own country. And that will work. That's what they should have done from day one. Put Iraqis back to work. And then with their right hand, the thing that everybody's going to be talking about, all the talking heads on TV and all the politicians and all the bloviators and everybody, oh, 20,000 troops, 30,000 troops, 15,000 troops, 9,000 troops, whatever it's going to be, everybody's going to get all hysterical about that. And, you know, whether it works or not is going to be pretty much irrelevant. But Bush is going to claim a year from now and 2 years from now, going into the 2008 elections, the Republicans are going to claim Bush's strategy for a surge worked. And John McCain, of course, will claim. Because there will have been a diminution of the violence that's going on in Iraq. But in my opinion, it will not be because of his so-called surge. It'll be because he's doing the Marshall Plan. He's just not talking about it. Now, it is in the paper. You can find it. You know, you read the story. The Bush administration is going to ask for more troops and $1 billion for Iraqis to engage in Iraqi reconstruction. But nobody's pointing out the fact that that's what it's really all about. Take your calls on this right after this. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
Hallelujah, dads and mommies, cowboys, rebels, yanks, and commies. Buy yourself some real red-blooded fun. If you want to make the grade, you've got to have a hand grenade and a fully automatic GI gun. So buy a gun for your son right away, sir. Shake his hand like a man and let him play, sir. Let his little mind expand, place a weapon in his hand, for the skills he learns today will someday pay, sir.
Indeed. Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room and say hi. And let's see here. Jay in Bernie, Texas. It says here, according to Lauren, you disagree with me. So I will put you right at the head of the line. Hey, Jay, what's up?
How you doing, Mr. Hartman?
Fine.
One thing I disagree on your statement is those people aren't fighting because they don't have jobs. They're fighting each other because of power.
You're talking about the Sunnis versus the Shia.
And dislike for each other. What's that?
You're talking about the Sunnis versus the Shia, or they're fighting us?
Yeah. Well, with the violence in Iraq. I mean, you made a statement that, you know, this Marshall Plan, and if they have jobs, mm-hmm. they stop fighting. But that's not why they're fighting. They don't like each other.
Well, actually, it's bigger than that. And the main issue is who's going to control the oil wealth. The Sunnis who, you know, Saddam Hussein was a Sunni, and so he was helping out his tribe or his clan or his bunch or whatever you want to call it. And that's why the Sunnis are still, you know, have turned him into a martyr. The Sunni areas, by and large, don't have oil. The Shia in the south and the Kurds in the north, they have oil. And yeah. So the Sunnis are freaked out that they're going to end up with a tripart state, you know, a three-partition state, and they're not going to have any oil.
Which our Constitution calls for.
Right, yeah. But I'm convinced that if there was a political solution that provided, you know, some of the oil wealth of the nation to provide for strong social services, if we were to undo the rewriting of the Constitution that L. Paul Bremer did and reinstate, you know, a strong national health care system, Social Security, food stamp essentially program for the very poor among them, and employment, that even the Sunni and the Shia would stop fighting among each other. I agree with you. There may continue to be some ethnic cleansing of neighborhoods. And I think that Joe Biden makes a good suggestion that we should consider balkanizing the area, like, you know, we did with Yugoslavia.
But Mr. Hartman,
yes,
that's
sir.
Not going to happen.
Why not?
So those Shiites and Sunnis, the Shiites do not want to make that type of deal. They're not. You say they're going to rewrite the Constitution. They're not going to rewrite the Constitution.
No, I don't.
The only way the fighting will stop in a civil war is when both sides agree the bloodshed is too much.
Yeah,
and that's when they'll stop the fighting.
Yeah, in other words, until one side has won.
That's correct. That's how all civil wars end.
No, not really. That's how many civil wars end. A lot of civil wars end by intervention of third parties. For example, the civil war in Kosovo. It is possible for a third party to intervene and say, wait a minute, we're going to make life better for everybody on both sides. And we're going to acknowledge the legitimate needs of all sides. And I think putting people back to work will accomplish that.
The Balkans ended by the balkanization of the countries and separating the
right, that's my point, and I suspect, and this is what Joe Biden is calling for, and I think that has to be a piece of it. But I'm telling you, a good chunk, a very large, in fact, probably the largest chunk of people who are fighting against us because they got nothing else to do. I think there's an awful lot of people who really are not all that committed to, I'm a Sunni, I'm going to kill Shias. I'm a Shia, I'm going to kill Sunnis. I mean, these are people who've been coexisting peacefully for a long, long time in that region. And it, certainly there have been ethnic tensions forever, but you've got large chunks of Baghdad where they're not only multi-ethnic, you've got people, you know, intermarried. And it's, in my opinion, it's the poverty, the horrible grinding poverty that's exacerbating the tensions.
But, well, they coexist because they had a jackboot of a dictator on them. And if there was any trouble, he would kill you.
Well, and they were coexisting before that, before the revolution in 1963, when they had a democratically elected president, you know. So I don't buy it. I'll acknowledge your point. But I just don't think that that's the entire thing. But, Jay, thank you for calling and sharing your opinion. It's a good one. Richard in Columbia, South Carolina. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I'm in total agreement with you on this employment aspect. I think that instead of giving Halliburton, who brought in about four different religions into a state that believes in only one and fights anybody else living in their country, we give all those billions of dollars to Halliburton, and what they bring in, they brought in Hindus and Buddhists and Christians and everybody else that will work at a cheap rate to work on land that is, the Islam religion believes that they should only occupy that property. What's our audacity to walk in there and not only take over the government, but then to bring on infidels, quote-unquote infidels, to take their jobs away and to rebuild the country when we gave all that money to Halliburton, and all they did was go out and get cheap labor and bring them in, and that pissed them off, and I don't blame them for being pissed off.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like as if Canada had invaded the United States and said, okay, we're only going to bring in people from the Church of England or something.
It's an imperfect
analogy, but good point and well made, Richard. Thank you very much for the call. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. In fact, talking back to the mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, 27 minutes past noon on the East Coast, past 9 in the morning on the West Coast, and all places in between. We'll be right back, right after this break.
Don't take your guns to town. Drank his first strong liquor then to calm his shaking hand and tried to tell himself at last he had become a man. A dusty cowpoke at his side began to laugh him down and he heard again his mother's words. Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town.
And welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Boy, it's so hard not to just let Johnny Cash play for the 3 minutes. By the way, January 12th, that's this weekend, I'll be at the Nevada Theater in Nevada City, California. Come and meet me at the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival for a brief talk and a screening of Crude Impact, a powerful and timely movie that explores the interconnection between human domination of the planet and the discovery and use of oil. It features me, Tom Hartman, in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. I'll be flying in and out of Sacramento for that, in fact. On January 25th and 6th, three weekends hence, in Washington, D.C., Friday and Saturday, I'll be at the State of the Union Radio Row, the Tom Hartman program, live from the Mayflower Hotel. That'll be at the USA Families USA Conference, familiesusa.com. January 25th, that night, there's going to be a press party at the Mayflower Hotel. It's open to the public. I'll be doing a book signing and speech on my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. And then March 1st and 2nd, the following weekend, can a liberal survive a conservative radio row? We'll find out. I'll be doing the American Conservative Union Foundation has invited me to sit on their radio row and talk with Vice President Dick Cheney, Ann Coulter, David Keene, Congressman Mike Pence, Governor Mitt Romney, and Newt Gingrich. We'll see how many of them are willing to go on the air with me. So anyhow, that's what's coming up, just as a heads up. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Chip in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Chip, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Great show, Tom.
Thank you.
What I wanted to comment on is I was in Yugoslavia in 1984 for a month, and while I was there, I had no hint that there was any tension between the people in Yugoslavia. their only anger seemed to be directed toward the government, but as soon as the government collapsed, even though they'd lived together in peace for 50 years, they started slaughtering each other immediately.
Right.
So I don't think the fact that, you know, that in Iraq they lived in peace for 50 years is going to make any difference.
Well, in Yugoslavia, it wasn't just that the government collapsed. It was also that the World Bank went in, the Wolfowitzes of the world, they went in and said, do shock therapy, just like in the Soviet Union. And you saw unemployment rise up to 30-40% in that part of the world. And again, my point is that if people have a job, they're much less inclined to fight with each other.
I agree with that.
If you've got people who have a job, they would much rather put food on the table and can take and care for their kids than shoot the guy next door because he's the wrong religion. I think that, frankly, this is one of the big problems in Northern Ireland, or it was for a long time. You read The Crack. It's not available in the United States. It's only published in the UK, but there's a great moving story. A reporter spent a year living, half a year with a Protestant family and half a year with a Catholic family. And by the time you get finished with that book, you get it, that one of the biggest problems going on in Northern Ireland wasn't sectarian violence. It was poverty.
I didn't know that. So,
yeah, and it's just, you know, I think you'll find this all over the country. You're absolutely right. When civil institutions fall apart, people will begin to fight. But I would say that one of those major civil institutions is the whole idea of having a job. But, Chip, thanks for the call. Good point, well made. Steve in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, Steve.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I'm not sure what the name of the guy is, but there's been a general who was just hired to spearhead the entire project. He was in charge of, I believe, northern Iraq and had the most success out of any other region, and it's because he implemented exactly what you were just saying, that the Bush administration is going to end up trying to push through without anybody seeing, and he's actually come out publicly and said that it needs to be a political, this needs to be solved.
Right, you have a political and economic solution. You need to put people back to work, and it's the Marshall Plan. I'm telling you, what they're going to do, what Bush is going to do in Congress is going to say, hey, good plan, yeah, sure, we'll give you $1 billion for that. I mean, after all, that's what we're spending in 5 days in Iraq anyway, with Bechtel and Halliburton. Bush is going to do a Marshall Plan. It's going to have some success, in my opinion, and he's going to credit all that success to his military action so that he can swagger around and play like he's a top dog big general.
Yeah. Do you know the name of the general I was talking about?
I don't have it right off the top of my head. I'm sorry, Dale, Steve, but I know what you're talking about, and I know who you're talking about.
The pieces are already set in motion for it to go down. So you're definitely dead on, and I'd like to find a way to get the word out to more people to be able to let them see that it's a political strategy and not a military one. And I also wanted to say that I caught you in Pittsburgh on Friday, and you were amazing, and I think we all appreciate you.
Oh, you were there
at
the book signing?
Pittsburgh. Yeah.
That was a hoot. We slammed that store. I mean, I don't think they had any idea. There was like 300-400 people there. It was packed.
Yeah,
whenever
you got that, at the end, when everybody stood up, you could really feel the energy in the room. You definitely got an impact here in Pittsburgh, and doing what you're doing.
Thank you. We're real pleased to be on WPTT. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for showing up last Friday night. Good talking with you. Steve in Grand Rapids, Michigan, WTKG. Hey, Steve.
Steve or Rick?
Rick, I'm sorry. That was Steve I was just talking to, wasn't it? You're Rick.
Yeah.
Hey, Rick.
How are you?
I am fine, but I'll get better.
And good luck with you facing Cheney and Coulter.
I don't think I'll have any problem. My question is, will they sit down opposite me? You know, when I did the RNC, there were a fair number of those folks, and they just refused to talk to me. We'll see what happens.
I was going to say that wasn't the topic of my call, but just one last comment on that. One of the toughest interviews I ever heard of her, Coulter, that is, was from a conservative talk show host, believe it or not,
mm-hmm.
who doesn't like the neocons. But anyway,
yeah.
I was watching C-SPAN and just caught a glimpse of a comment that Senator Joe Biden, who apparently is running for president, was quoted.
Yeah.
I forget what newspaper, but he says he doesn't think that the Congress has any constitutional right, and I may be paraphrasing here, basically to micromanage what the commander-in-chief, any commander-in-chief. Now, as I understand the Constitution, number one, the Congress does not declare war. Since December 8th of 1941, they've been remiss in that for over 60 years. They certainly have the right of the power of the purse.
Yep.
And this whole business of the commander-in-chief, the reason the president, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is the commander-in-chief is because our first president was George Washington, who was a great general.
No, our president is commander-in-chief because that's the job he's given in the Constitution.
Right, but I think that was the reason.
He should be commander-in-chief of the armed forces and the Navy. And,
right.
And Joe Biden is right. Congress does not have the power or the authority to micromanage his behavior. What they can do is they can say, we're not going to pay for it anymore.
But
if he wants to add or subtract 5 or 10,000 troops and he can figure out a way to do it in the budget that he already has, Congress has no say in it.
Well, sure, but I mean, the Congress certainly should be consulted as an equal, co-equal branch of government, which they are. Correct?
You would think so. I mean, you know, that's a very rational response, Rick, a very rational response, but I frankly doubt it's going to happen.
I don't think he even did it that much with the Republican Congress, did he?
No, he didn't. He didn't do it with anybody. Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Good point. Dale in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Dale.
Hey, thanks so much, Tom, for taking my call. Really love the show.
And thank you for listening to Sirius Radio.
Want to just ask you to keep up the propaganda work and remind people it's starting to work. Congressmen and senators are saying that this is an escalation, not a surge.
And an occupation, not a war.
Exactly. The war was over, like you said a while ago, when our little commander-in-chief strutted around on the aircraft carrier. The quote-unquote threat was removed, and we had taken charge of the country then. So I want to just keep hammering away, and I really appreciate your efforts, and I'm going to send you another message about some program thoughts.
Great. Thank you very much, Dale. Thanks. Good to hear from you. I appreciate the call. Emma in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Hey, Emma, welcome to the program.
Hi. I was just reading The State of Denial by Bob Woodward, and he talks about a Jay Garner who was a retired person that...
Jay Garner was the general who was originally in charge of Iraq who wanted to hold elections immediately, and the neocons said, oh, wait a minute. No, we're not going to have elections. We're going to rewrite the Constitution. We're going to turn this into a neocon paradise. And Gardner wanted to do it the legal way, according to the Geneva Conventions and the Hague Conventions, and they threw him out.
Well, he also was put in charge early on, way early on, in the Reconstruction effort, and he had been the one that was up in the Kurdish regions helping them get reconstructed. And he actually got together as much as he could possibly do it with what little resource he had. Mm-hmm. But no one paid any attention to him. And when Brenner was put on blind, he essentially said, well, I'm out of here. I, you know, was forced to and asked to do this. Right. And nobody's listening to me anyway. I'm going home. And he couldn't get through to Bremer, Rumsfeld, nobody wanted to hear him.
Yeah, good point, Emma. And so instead what happens is George W. Bush's old roommate from Andover Prep School comes in, Paul Bremer, and brings in Halliburton and Bechtel and all these other companies and says, to hell with the Iraqi companies. We don't need an Iraqi cement company. We don't need an Iraqi contractor. Iraqis don't need jobs. We'll just open this up to the so-called free market or we'll make big bucks for our friends. And all the more the tragedy. Emma, thank you for the call and good point. Scott in Arkansas. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Outstanding. First of all, let me apologize. I listen via podcast, so I'm always a day or two behind on the subjects. But this last signing statement that Bush signed about the postal reform, that is just really bothering the hell out of me.
Well, the postal workers, there's a fellow, Jeffrey Richardson, who's put together a website on this thing, and Postal Workers United Against Tyranny. The website is postalworkersunited.blogspot.com. And so I'd suggest you get over there and check it out. There's things you can do, action steps. We all need to become radio activists, right? Radioactive here! And you can do it over at postalworkersunited.blogspot.com. A lot of Americans pushing back against this. 45 minutes past the hour.
I ain't looking to compete with you. Beat or cheat or mistreat you. Simplify you. Pacify you, deny, defy, or crucify you. All I really wanna do is maybe be friends with you.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Fair and slightly unbalanced. It's listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners. Listen to your local stations for your local advertisers. In fact, Friday night was a Saturday night. I was in Minneapolis Minneapolis, St. Paul, and went to dinner with Janet, the owner of KTNF, or one of the owners there, AM 950, which carries our program, our Minneapolis affiliate, to the Signature Cafe, owned by Natalie and Tony, who were actually there, you know, the owners running the restaurant, and they advertise on the radio station, and they get great results. You know, this is Weed Garden in the chat room has been blogging about how, you know, Progressive Talk Radio, you know, there's all these ads for grow more hair or something. No, what we, therefore it isn't working, my response was, no, we just need to get people who know how to sell progressive advertising. I mean, it's really simple. There are progressive stations like the one that I'm broadcasting from here in Portland, Oregon, KPOJ, that are financially very successful, thank you very much, because we've got a dedicated sales force of folks like Randy White, who's sitting in the studio here with me right now, who's a progressive, and he goes out and he finds progressive businesses like Tom Dwyer Automotive here in town, who runs an ad. Say that loud.
Tom Dwyer, Blossoming Lotus, everybody, that they get amazing results.
Yeah. I mean, that's the bottom line. We've got an advertiser here on KPOJ, Tom Dwyer Automotive, who starts his ads by saying, I'm Tom Dwyer, and I support Tom Hartman, and I'm worried about fascism in America. And by the way, bring your car in to have it fixed, you know, have it tuned up. I mean, it's incredible. You sold that ad, Randy, right?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. And he gets repeat business, referral business. It's good. You actually have to have a great service. You can't just be progressive, but the fact that you are, everybody listening knows that there's a loyalty there, and we're doing great, so yes, definitely. Thank you for that, Tom.
Yeah, you're welcome, Randy. Yeah, and so the bottom line is Progressive Talk Radio does work, can work, and so listen to the sponsors of your local station, patronize them, and when you come across progressive companies, ask them, hey, why aren't you advertising on our local progressive station? And, of course, patronize our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, Saving the Planet One Cup at a Time, SacredGrounds.com, Small Dog Electronics, SmallDog.com, the organic wine company, EcoWine.com, and like that there. Vic in Cedar Creek, Texas, on the line. Hey, Vic, welcome to the program.
That Tom's a fast talker.
Yeah, indeed.
You gotta get it in.
Yeah, indeed.
My local oil well plane is flying overhead now, and I'm outside. Hey, I got a comment on that Joe Biden thing when he's talking about that the Congress can't constitutionally do anything to the president or to stop the president. And what I think's ironic, and you're a student of the Constitution, is that the whole damn thing to begin with was unconstitutional.
Yes. You know, I would agree with you, because there was no official declaration of war.
It's like additional crimes. You were talking about, and that other fellow that just called up was talking about the separation of powers, and that's why we Madison, who you often refer to, created the weak government, so we wouldn't have a tyrannical central government.
Yes, in fact, James Madison said, "No nation, no democracy can survive in a state of perpetual war."
The Congress finds itself in a quandary in that it unconstitutionally gave permission, and a lot of those folks are still around. So they're, you know, it's a catch-22.
Well, a lot of them, though, Vic, are saying, "Oops." I mean, we now have a majority of people. If the vote were held today in the United States Senate, the United States Senate would vote no to give George Bush that power. So, you know, it's a good step in the right direction. But go ahead.
I think the reason they're hanging on is it's kind of like the generals of the Third Reich, you know, that damned if they do, damned if they don't. Yeah. So at the end of the war, they strung them up after the Nuremberg trials. But they certainly didn't back down from global conquest.
Yeah.
Even though the war was lost.
Yeah. Good point. Good point, Vic. Thank you very much. Charles in Georgetown, Kentucky. Hey, Charles.
Hey, Don. I was thinking that the Democrats could really capitalize on the knowledge you have about his plan to implement parts of the Marshall Plan and go ahead and finance and maybe double the financial effort and stay away from the surge.
Yes, and the Democrats should call it the new Marshall Plan, and they should call it their own idea. They should brand this thing immediately.
I think if this were played correctly, it could really expose some of the war profiteering that we've had from these companies and show how they have contributed to the the violence in Greece.
Yeah, and not just contributed to that. It's also contributed to the $300-400 billion that we have wasted over there in large part. George, good point. Thank you very much. John in Michigan, quick question about what my book's
for. Oh, yeah. I didn't think you were going to get to me before you went to your break.
Oh, we got about 30 seconds, John. What's up?
I'm sorry. I just wanted to know you where you got your facts from as far as for your book. I was quite interested in reading it, but... I just want to know if that was opinion or did you base it on something that you knew or...
There is an index. There is an index in the back. And so any statements that we make in the book that are, you know, that using numbers and things like that, you can find them in the index. Just track that.
The only reason I ask that is because I know I believe that the O'Reilly book, you know, I haven't read that and I don't want to read it, The Culture Warrior. I believe that that's a lot of opinion. I don't know that he's making it necessarily fact.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have written books of opinion, but Screwed is not one of them.
Yeah, no, I would hope that there's facts.
Tom Hartman.
Point.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot, John. And yeah, Alex, you had to do it, didn't you?
It's good Screwed by Tom Hartman.
Oh, yes. Thanks a lot for the call, though. 57 minutes past the hour. After the top of the news, Scott Ritter going to be with us with an update. What's going to go on with Iran here? We talked with Scott 4 or 5 months ago. He said, get ready. Let's see what he's saying these days. So this should be really an interesting interview. I'm looking forward to it. Plus, we're going to be talking with Medea Benjamin live down in Havana. She's in Cuba right now. They're getting ready to march on Guantanamo. And that you'll find that a very interesting discussion as well. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Or at least, you know, clean elections, national health care, clean environment, and world peace. You know, we'd really settle for that. Scott Ritter is with us, a former Marine, former UNSCOM senior weapons inspector, the author of several books. I believe your most recent one is Target Iran, Scott?
That's correct.
Target Iran. And you and I had a conversation back 4, 5, 6 months ago on this program in which I put forward my crackpot theory that Bush was going to invade Iran or get Israel to do so before the elections in order to help the Republicans. And you said, no, it's going to happen in March because that's when, you know, the time will be right militarily. And so I thought I'd just do an update with you, find out, you know, what your thoughts are and what's going on. The report in the Sunday Times of London about Iran or about Israel now preparing to drop conventional weapons into Iran to open holes into which they can drop nuclear weapons. The U.S., we've got a new aircraft carrier group streaming into the area. What's going on?
Well, I mean, I'm more concerned about the U.S. aircraft carrier than I am about the Sunday Times talk about Israeli involvement. I stand by my assessment, which is the Israelis can do a one-time shot on Iran, but they can't sustain it.
Right.
And it would be suicide for Israel to attack Iran, and the Israelis know it. I'm more concerned about the second carrier battle group going into the area because I'm fairly confident that within a month or so you'll see a third carrier battle group going in the area, again, ostensibly just to ratchet up the pressure. And once you got three carrier battle groups in the area, you can now surge a fourth from the Mediterranean, a fifth from the Indian Ocean, and now you've got critical mass to initiate and sustain an aerial bombardment. And this is the kind of under-the-radar military buildup that I'm very concerned of. I'm also very concerned that the Democratic-controlled Congress, doesn't have its eye on the ball when it comes to Iran, and B, even when they do look at Iran, if you take a look at statements made by Nancy Pelosi's deputy, the man she just appointed, I don't have his last name with me right now, Havi or something like that, Hovey, he just gave an interview where he said that, you know, military options not off the table when it comes to Iran. This is a man together with Nancy Pelosi who have spoken at the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee recently and have put out very harsh rhetoric against Iran. warlike rhetoric. And so while some people talk about this new Democratic Congress as being, you know, a Congress of peace, pushing for peace in Iraq, again, I stand by what I've said all along. It's not that they're against the war in Iraq. They're against us losing in Iraq. And because they haven't taken a stance about why we got to Iraq to begin in the first place, they're making the same mistakes vis-a-vis Iran, and we're heading dangerously down the path towards confrontation with Iran.
And I think the neocons have been doing their homework. I mean, they've been out there, Gingrich and the whole bunch. What's his name, the former CIA director?
Woolsey.
Yeah, James Woolsey. They've been out there for 6 months now, basically doing their be afraid, be very afraid. I had on my morning show, I had a guy call in this morning saying, well, it sounds to me like you're just not taking seriously the threat from Iran. What are you going to do when they've got a couple dozen nuclear weapons and they start selling them to terrorists and one of them goes off in Manhattan? And my response was, you know, I'm frankly much more concerned about Musharraf. You know, he's got Pakistan's got nuclear weapons, and you know, he's got Mr. Khan running around the world, you know, was selling them to anybody who wanted them, and Khan is living the life of Riley. What's your response to that kind of feedback?
Well, I always ask the people, what facts can they bring to the table? I mean, I hear, you know, hyped up politicized rhetoric. It's the same sort of fear mongering that took place when you had the president and others say that, you know, when the Iraqis tested a remotely piloted vehicle that they were using for aerial reconnaissance, you know, suddenly people are saying, oh, my goodness, this thing has a range of 500 kilometers. Now, that wasn't a one-way range out, one-way range back. That was based upon it flying around in circles for 500 kilometers. And suddenly you have congressmen like Duncan Hunter standing up and saying, the Iraqis can now put these RPVs on cargo ships, sail them in the harbor of the United States, launch them, and drop biological weapons on our cities, killing millions. And I went, wow, you just made that up, because there's nothing out there whatsoever to back up anything you just said. And I would say the same thing to anybody who called in and said, what would you say about the Iranians getting dozens of nuclear weapons? I'd say, first of all, establish that they have a nuclear weapons program to begin with.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can't do that, we're not going anywhere else with this conversation. And right now, all the facts point to a program that is dedicated to the peaceful use of nuclear energy.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Iran has signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement, is that right?
They not only have signed it, they're in full compliance with it.
Okay, and are there UNSCOM inspectors in Iran?
Not UNSCOM, UNSCOM only dealt with...
IAEA, yeah.
Yep.
There are inspectors inside Iran.
Absolutely. Now, they're operating in accordance with the Non-Proliferation Treaty's Old Safeguards Agreement, which, again, is within the framework of law. It is desirable, and indeed, you know, the world should be encouraging Iran to enter into what's called the additional protocol, and I would even say additional protocol plus of inspections, which Iran had agreed to do voluntarily from 2002 to 2005. We had more inspectors in place, gaining access to even, you know, more critical sites in Iran, and then, thanks to the United States and their irresponsible policy, the Iranians have said, hey, we're not going to, you know, allow these additional inspections if you're going to say that, A, you're going to attack us, and B, what we're doing is illegal. If you want to play by the law, I'll tell you what the law is. The law is you're only allowed to have a certain number of inspectors, and that's all we're going to do. And so, thanks to the United States, the Iranians have shut down a program of inspection that they had agreed to that's above and beyond that which they're legally required to do. And we have fewer inspectors in Iran today.
But they are doing what they're legally required to do.
Well, absolutely.
Scott Redder, why is it, if Iran is a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement, is in full compliance with it, and there's no evidence that they're enriching fuel beyond the 3.5% or so necessary for nuclear power, certainly not up to the 90% necessary to make weapons, and Ahmadinejad has actually come out and said it would be a violation of Islam to create a nuclear weapon. Well, if all of those things are true, and I think we're in agreement that they are, why is it that the mainstream media is at every turn talking about the Iranian crisis, the Iranian threat? I mean, I've even heard supposedly progressive talk show hosts talk in these terms.
Well, I'd say, first of all, they're playing to a market, and that is a market of ignorant Americans who are easily manipulated by playing on their the fear of the unknown.
Well, we've also got Ahmadinejad saying outrageous things, you know, about Israel and the Holocaust.
Well, he has said some very outrageous things. But, you know, here's the interesting thing. I challenge everybody who's gone about and quoted Ahmadinejad to actually tell me the actual quote and put it into context. And what you'll find is they're not quoting a transcript. They're quoting what somebody said, somebody said, somebody said, Ahmadinejad said. Mm. If you go to the actual transcript and then actually get a Persian linguist to go through the transcript, you'll find that Ahmadinejad never said what he's accused of saying. He said some, you know, difficult things to swallow if you're an Israeli, such as if the Israelis continue with their barbaric occupation of the Palestinian people, then the Palestinian people and Islam will not rest until Zionism is wiped off the face of the earth. Now, that got turned into Israel must be wiped off the face of the earth. He never said that.
Hmm.
He said the Palestinian people will not rest until Zionism is wiped off the face of the earth.
But aren't we in kind of a weird position here when we're taking the side of a guy who, you know, isn't exactly a small-D Democrat?
Ahmadinejad?
Yeah.
You know, last time I checked, he was elected democratically.
Well, you're right. Good point.
And so, you know, again, all these points that people bring up, he is the democratically elected leader of a sovereign state exercising their legal sovereign rights. And he has said things about a nation, Israel, that he has, that his nation has, you know, let's just say differences of opinion regarding the Palestinian issue.
Yeah.
You know, what if we held every American politician accountable for the outrageous things they say about
it would be
you know, I'm not here defending Ahmadinejad, but I don't want to single this guy out either. I think it's irresponsible for us to pull him out of context.
Yeah,
I
Scott, we just have 10 seconds left. What's the benefit to the U.S. of this? Why are these guys pushing so hard for this?
Well, again, this is a policy of global domination that's derived from the neoconservatives' position ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union, that we should fill the vacuum that the collapse created. So regional domination is what they're all about, and we need to take care of Iran if we're going to achieve that.
Amazing. Scott Ritter, author of Target Iran, among others. Scott, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Always great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program. Viagra for your brain. Just don't tell Limbaugh. He'll want some. We'll be right back. And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. Now, this is the report. Our number, by the way, 1-866-440-THOM. TomHartmann.com if you'd like to drop into our live chat room. The Sunday Times of London, owned by Rupert Murdoch, by the way, but it's essentially the New York Times of the UK, revealed Israel plans nuclear strike on Iran. Oddly, it's reported by two reporters in New York and Washington. Israel has drawn up secret plans, they write, to destroy Iran's uranium enrichment facilities with tactical nuclear weapons. Two Israeli Air Force squadrons are training to blow up an Iranian facility using low-yield bunker busters, according to several Israeli military sources. Under the plans, conventional laser-guided bombs would open tunnels into the targets. Mini-nukes would then immediately be fired into a plant at Natanz, exploding deep underground to reduce the risk of radioactive fallout. One of the sources said, as soon as the green light is given, it will be one mission, one strike, and the Iranian nuclear project will be demolished. Israeli and American officials have met several times to consider military action, according to the Times of London. Israeli pilots have flown to Gibraltar in recent weeks to train for the 2,000-mile round trip to the Iranian targets. Air Force squadrons based at Nazarim in the Negev Desert and Tel Nof, south of Tel Aviv, have trained to use Israel's tactical nuclear weapons on the mission. The preparations have been overseen by Israeli Major General Eliezer Shekhedi, commander of the Israeli Air Force. Forgive me if I'm mispronouncing. Sources close to the Pentagon said the United States was highly unlikely to give approval for tactical nuclear weapons to be used. One source said that Israel would have to seek approval after the event, as it did when it crippled Iraq's nuclear reactor at Osirak with airstrikes in 1981. Yeah, well, we'll see how it all shakes out. And, of course, the big news, all over the top of the, you know, the New York Times and Huffington Post and everything else, it smells funny in Manhattan. Nobody can figure out why. Well, I know why. It's, you know, the aliens have been here too long. The pigeons. You know, the mothership comes down and drops them off. Whenever there's a world event anywhere, what do you find? Pigeons. They're spies from outer space. They're spies from the planet Xenon or whatever, you know, wherever the Scientologists sent us, you know, whoever seeded us 10,000 years ago, checking out the human race. And apparently the mothership hasn't come on time, and their little nuclear reactors that power them are, you know, starting to run out of gas and producing funny fumes. That's my theory. The proof of it? Well, you've never seen a dead pigeon. You've never seen a baby pigeon. So they must be space aliens. No other way to explain it. Janice in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. David's doing his circles around the ear thing. Yeah.
That was great. I love that.
It's all tongue-in-cheek. Hey, Janice.
Yes. I just wanted to tell you that on my way home from work Friday night, I had on Mr. Wiener, you know, Mr. Savage.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've gotten to be able to tolerate these people a little bit since Nancy Pelosi's Speaker of the House.
Yeah. For folks who don't know, by the way, Michael Savage was born Michael Wiener. He changed his name to go on the radio. Yeah.
You're right. Well, do you know he was ranting and raving and saying that Air America is dead, that it's bankrupt, and it's gone?
Yeah, well, here we are.
I know, but you know what? Everybody should hear and listen for these people, and if you have an opportunity, let them know otherwise.
Yeah. You know what's so funny, Janice, is Fox News, the official mouthpiece of the Republican Party, Fox News lost $100 million a year for 5 years. $500 million
that
they lost before they started making money. They eventually started making money. Typically, a business does lose money for the first couple of years. Air America's lost, what, $22 million, $26 million, something like that, in 2 years? That's nothing. That's nothing. That's chicken feed. It's amazing that they have lost so little. And frankly, I think, you know, I've seen the, you know, so I've talked to some of the folks and seen some of the plans to turn the company around. You know, they're doing fine. Air America's doing fine. I'm not worried about it at all. Progressive Talk Radio. That's the point that I was making earlier. What was really supposed to just be, you know, a plug for our sponsors, but really turned into a political point, I suppose, is that those Progressive Talk Radio stations that are being run at, you know, professionally, that are being run by people who know how to run a radio station, do it well, and make the decision to hire progressive salespeople to hire some progressive product. Just like if you've got a country western station, you want to hire people who like country western music selling your advertising.
Right.
You know, if you got somebody selling cars, you want somebody who knows about cars, you
right.
know, and cares about them and likes them and has a certain enthusiasm about them. This is common sense. This is ad sales 101. Those stations that are doing that are doing very well, thank you very much,
right.
and they're making good money. And I think it's just going to be, frankly, I think this is a good thing. The tough times that some of these stations are going through, and, you know, Madison, you know, going up to the edge and pulling back, because it's bringing the discussion out into the open, and a lot of people are waking up to it. Janice, thank you for the call.
Well, I support your sponsors.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
And thank you. And thank you for listening to us there on WPTT. And be sure to let the station know, too, that you're listening. That's another important part of it, because most program directors, frankly, don't have the time to listen to the programming on their station. They're too busy doing business. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be back with your calls and more right after this. And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you, 35 minutes past the hour. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com. Are pigeons really robots from outer space? When they run low on power, do they start to smell like an old gas oven? Is that what's going on in Manhattan? Is the is it illegal that we have concentration camps in Guantanamo Bay? Perhaps a more apropos question. A few hours ago, I spoke with Medea Benjamin. Medea is the co-founder of Code Pink, and you know, one of this nation's most outspoken progressive activists, and she's down in Havana, Cuba. And so here's my conversation with Medea. Medea Benjamin is with us live from Cuba, from Havana. Medea, welcome.
Thank you very much. How you doing?
I am just great. I'm so glad to hear that somebody is taking the fight to the, you know, I almost slipped into one of Bush's cliches there, but you're part of a 12-person international delegation traveling in Cuba this week. Obviously, also, you're the co-founder of the human rights group Global Exchange and Code Pink Women for Peace. But there's also, isn't there one other group that's involved with this, or is this the two of you, these two organizations?
Well, those groups organize the delegation, but we have people coming from groups like Gold Star Families for Peace, that's Cindy Sheehan, we have Veterans for Peace, Anne Wright, and most importantly, we have a former prisoner and the mother and a brother of a current prisoner.
So tell us, what's happening, what are you doing, what are you seeing, and what do you hope to have come out of this, Medea?
We have been in Havana for the past couple of days making our arrangements to go to Guantanamo. We will be going there on the night of the 9th, tomorrow, and we'll be doing a conference in the city of Guantanamo with some of the foremost legal experts on the issue, like Bill Goodman from the Center for Constitutional Rights, testimonies from former prisoners and family members, all day on the 10th, and then we'll be doing a march from the city of Guantanamo to the Cuban entrance of the base, where we'll be doing a ceremony and an international call as part of an international day of action for the base to be shut down.
The city of Guantanamo, I'm assuming, is a Cuban city.
It is a Cuban city. It used to be that a lot of Cubans crossed regularly into the base to work. That doesn't happen anymore, and there's really like a no man's land of minefields between the Cuban side and the U.S. side. We will hopefully also be able to go to the lookout station where you can see the prison from the top of the lookout station.
I'm curious, Medea Benjamin. Go ahead.
I was going to say that this will be the closest that the mother and brother of a prisoner have gotten to their son in the last 5 years, and I'm sure it will be a very dramatic anguishing experience. One of the former prisoners just arrived yesterday, and he's been with us all day today telling us his horror stories about how he was picked up in Afghanistan as somebody who believes that they were paying $5,000 just to pick people up off the streets and hand them into the Americans as terrorists. He was picked up, spent 2.5 years in prison, and was released with no charges and just bears the scars of 2.5 years of being treated like an animal.
And as I recall, the mother who is with you of one of the detainees, her son has been blinded in one eye as a result of his interrogation and imprisonment.
That's right. His son has been blinded. He's been subjected to all kinds of abuse from the time that he was captured in Pakistan and taken to an Afghanistan base and then taken to Guantanamo, everything from sleep deprivation to sexual humiliation to constant beatings that resulted in him being blind in one eye.
That's absolutely tragic. I'm curious, Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink and Global Exchange, down in Havana now, preparing to march on Guantanamo Bay over the next couple of days. I'm curious how you navigated the minefield of U.S. foreign policy to get a, you know, to get legally to Havana, and whether you expect to be arrested when you return. My understanding is it's against the law for American citizens to go to Cuba unless they have the permission of the State Department.
Well, we feel that we are here legally because under the regulations, you are allowed to attend a professional conference sponsored by an international organization if you are a full-time professional in the field. We are all full-time professional human rights activists. But let me also say, Tom, that whether or not we fit into the U.S. strict categories, we would have come anyway. And it could very well happen that the U.S. government doesn't believe that this fits within their category of a professional conference for us to be studying the conditions and their treatment of prisoners in Guantanamo. So we came with the understanding that the U.S. government might not treat this as a legal delegation and certainly might harass us and try to institute some kind of procedures against us when we return.
Isn't it bizarre that a country, our country, that preaches, you know, open borders and tolerance and anybody should be able to go anywhere, would prosecute its own citizens for going to another country? It's mind-boggling. And at that point, I'm back live here now, at that point we discovered that we had lost the phone connection to Cuba and were unable to recover it. So that was our conversation with Medea Benjamin. And I think, you know, it's extraordinary that she's down there and that she's doing that. And so far has not yet run afoul of the Bush administration, although we'll see. We'll see what happens. Karl Rove, as aggressive as ever. Just some of the points in the news here, and things that I think are worth mentioning. This from let's see here, where did this come from? U.S. News and World Report. Insiders suggest that Karl Rove had a big hand in distancing George W. Bush from the Iraq study group because he believed the bipartisan panel was too critical of current Iraq policy. Rove, aides say, believed that victory is still achievable and that Bush should pursue it as vigorously as he can, end quote. And as I said, I think it's entirely possible that if George W. Bush were to adopt the policies of George Marshall, of Harry Truman, or of Bill Clinton, for that matter, in Yugoslavia, I mean, all he has to do is just look at the lessons of history, that it's not too late, that it is still possible for us to have something that resembles, or, you know, obviously so much damage has been done, something that resembles civil order in Iraq. The probability is, of course, after the fact, that what will happen is that the majority of Iraq will become a Shiite Iranian-affiliated country. And this is where Bush is just blowing it so badly. You have Ahmadinejad in the last elections actually essentially losing the election. I mean, you know, he's still the president, but the people that he was supporting, the policies that he was supporting, not going along with him, his popularity rating running 15-20%. He's running around yelling about Israel and the Holocaust and all this stuff, largely for domestic consumption and the region. You know, he wants to be famous and well thought of in the region. But the bottom line is that he's not doing all that well. And that there have been several times, a number of times actually, over the last 10 years or so, particularly right after 9/11, oddly enough, ironically enough, when the street, the Iranian street, was very pro-American, when the sense of Iranians was, you know, we ought to go with the Americans. We should be on their side. We should be, you know, let's establish a bond with the Americans. And the average Iranian, you talk with people who've been in Iran, who've come back from Iran. We've done that a number of times on this program, and they come back and they say, you know, the average Iranian thinks well of Americans. We like the idea of your Fourth Amendment having the right to privacy. We like the idea of your First Amendment having free speech. And then you say to them, well, you know, Bush is taking away the Fourth Amendment and taking away the First Amendment and all that kind of thing. But nonetheless, they say, you know, we kind of like it. We think it's kind of a cool idea. And then Bush starts calling them the Axis of Evil, and he goes off ballistic, and now we're talking about bombing them, and let's drop nukes on them, and let's bring carrier battles in, and, you know, battleships in, and all these kind of, it's just the wrong, I mean, I suppose it's the right way to do it, if what you're all about is military domination, and you don't care how many lives are lost in the process, and apparently that's Bush's perspective. Anyhow, time now for today's Progressive Pop Quiz. Our question for the day, what's the name of the plan that Harry Truman put into place to rebuild Europe? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 1-866-440-THOM, 866-440-8466, gets a personalized and autographed copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. Answer right after the break, 45 minutes past the hour.
Remember the democracy's start with you. Tag your in. The president kicked democracy out the door and he shipped it off to a foreign shore. Giving birth instead to a holy war. I don't know why those Iraqis got so sore, we only killed 100,000 or more. It's called collateral damage when you're waging war.
And welcome back, folks. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The place where reason is our lifestyle choice. We have a winner in our Progressive Pop Quiz. Once again, our question of the day, what's the name of the plan Harry Truman put in place to rebuild Europe? And congratulations to Rob Strikars. Rob knew that the correct answer of Chicopee, Mass., by the way, Rob knew that the correct answer is the Marshall Plan. And as I said, you want to hear the news before it's the news. Listen to this show. I'm telling you, you're going to see a modified version of the Marshall Plan coming out of the Bush administration as George's way of resurrecting something, of salvaging, rather, is the appropriate word, I think, salvaging something out of this debacle. But he is this absolute mess that he's created in Iraq. Speaking of the news, before it's the news, Larissa Alexandrova writing over in Raw Story today. You'll recall last week, last Friday, when I was broadcasting live from WPTT in Pittsburgh, I made the point that the appointment of retired Vice Admiral John Michael McConnell, otherwise known as Mike McConnell, to be the Director of National Intelligence, to take over from Death Squad John Negroponte, was because this guy's a military guy, and this is part of Bush getting ready for the invasion of Iran, which I believe is going to come in March. And sure enough, here's Larissa's article today. Remember, I was saying this Friday. I'm not saying that she was listening to me and got it. You know, she was apparently doing the reporting because she's quoting a number of sources here. The nomination of retired Vice Admiral John Michael Mike McConnell to be Director of National Intelligence, she writes, is part of an effort by the Vice President. See, it's always all about Cheney, right? It's always all about Cheney. By the Vice President to tighten the administration's grip on domestic intelligence and grease the wheels for a more aggressive stance towards Iran. So we'll see if my prediction is right or not. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
Well, Wednesday night, thank you so much. Wednesday night is the big night for the president's speech on Iraq, and already we're hearing things from the right wing saying, well, you know, you guys always said there shouldn't be so many there should be more troops, and now you're getting what you want. You know, you guys are never happy with anything, and sort of that's one front of theirs. The other front is that there's real considerable questions about, you know, you've seen people blame the military, and these are Republicans blaming the military now, saying that they're the ones that never went in with enough troops to begin with. But of course it was your friend Mr. Cheney, who you were just talking about. Didn't mean to call him your friend. who, you know, essentially did the war planning.
Yeah, Cheney and Rumsfeld, who were Minnie and Mickey back in the Ford administration.
Right. So now they're trying to blame, they're putting all this onto the generals.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because it was Bush who a year and a half ago said, you know, if we escalate that's going to be a bad thing. We shouldn't be doing that. And now you've got Chuck Hagel saying it's Alice in Wonderland. You got John Ensign from Nevada saying, you know, he did not express immediate objection to a troop increase, but emphasized they do not want to prejudge the president's strategy. That from Congress Daily. Joe Lieberman. After speaking with our military commanders on the ground, I strongly believe that additional U.S. troops must be deployed to Baghdad. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. You know, how's this going to play out with the Democrats?
Well, it's hard to really know how it's going to play out with the Democrats because the Democrats really don't have a coherent strategy. When you have, you know, as I said to you earlier this morning, when you have Steny Hoyer saying, oh, yeah, we're prepared to, you know, or going into Iran is not off the table. And then you have Nancy Pelosi saying no blank check. And then you have Dennis Kucinich and the Progressive Caucus saying no way to both. You do not have a unified response the Democratic Party.
Yeah. Now, in December of 1974, the Democratic majority in Congress passed the Foreign Assistance Act of 1974, which cut off all the military funding to the government of South Vietnam and, you know, essentially sealed the fate of the entire thing. And Gerry Ford, of course, was now president, and Ford presided over the collapse of that, you know, our departure from Vietnam, shall we say. You don't think that there's any possibility that the Democrats are going to do something like this again?
I think nothing is off the table. I would put it as pretty slim, actually.
Yeah. Now,
but nothing's totally off. I mean, who knows what they're going to do? Because, honestly, I haven't seen any coherent statements, any coherent policy at all. Have you?
Well, sort of. My theory is that Bush is going to go in and he's going to do a Marshall Plan. He's going to hand $1 billion over to the Iraqis, and they're going to start putting Iraqis back to work. They're going to restart some of the Iraqi industries that they've privatized, and that's actually going to do some good. And then he's going to claim, and then when things start calming down because people are back to work, he's going to say, see, it was the surge that did it.
Well,
and he's going to claim credit for it.
I don't disagree with that, but I don't think $1 billion is going to do it.
Yeah, well, $1 billion is a lot in a country where the average annual income is $500 a year.
Well, it's about $2 a day. You're right.
Yeah, it could put a lot of people to work. So, you know, we'll see. It's going to be interesting to watch. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Oh, my goodness. Well, we will continue with this. Also, life on Mars? Looks like maybe we killed it. And should people be messing with their kids if they're in a vegetative state to keep them from growing? This is an interesting question.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. Over on our website, where we have our message board. Go to TomHartman.com and click on the message board, not the live chat room, which is full of folks talking and providing us with some interesting and useful information from time to time, debating whether or not the pigeons are actually space aliens. One of the folks, I forget who it was now, suggested that the smell in New York is actually coming from the EIB studios. But in any case, over on our message boards, where you can post messages and you know, read them, and you know, there's a couple hundred thousand of them over there. One, Kingsrook 5 says, on yesterday's show, several callers called in after Yaron Brooke had already had his debate with Tom with questions essentially for people of the libertarian mindset. Tom more or less answered, well, I can't speak for Yaron, but I think the belief is it's essentially XYZ. Question, Tom, What would you think about leaving Yaron on post-debate to take some listener questions directly, much like the Brunch with Bernie segment? I would very much like to hear his responses to some of the questions that some of the listeners have posed. We've done that in the past. We've done that a couple of times. We did it with David Tebow once, and we've done it with Yaron. And I think in small doses, it's probably a good idea, and we'll do that one of these days. The problem we have when we do it on a regular basis, it just gets to be too much. It's no longer the Tom Harpin program. It becomes the Aaron Brooks show. And I don't mind turning the program over to Bernie 1 hour a day, one day a week, 1 hour a week. In fact, I think it's a great thing because people love the idea of being able to call a member of Congress and actually get a straight answer from somebody. But given all the right wingers that we debate, once in a while, sure, yeah, we'll consider this. Here's another one. This is from Ampersand Andy. Yeah, David, Tom, relative to urging last week to get active again, I have a tip on how to reach congressional leaders and committee members. If you're not a constituent, it's worked well for me. Thought you might want to share it with your audience. Number one, call the congressional switchboard. You can use toll free numbers for this: 877-762-8762. 888-355-3588, which is usually the one that I give out. 800-426-8073, 888-818-6641. And these can change, and in fact they do from time to time. Number two, ask the leadership office or committee office instead of the legislator by name. For example, to reach Nancy Pelosi, ask for the House Speaker's leadership office. For Harry Reid, ask for the Senate leadership office. For John Conyers, ask for the majority office of the House Judiciary Committee. Why does this work? Because the leadership offices receive fewer calls and don't use answering machines. Because relative to a legislator's national leadership or role in a national task group, every voter is a constituent. Whereas if you're simply calling for the individual and you don't live in their area, theoretically you're not a constituent. Good point. Good point. Thank you very much for making that. We may have discovered life on Mars and in the process killed it. Seth Borenstein, in the Associated Press, two NASA space probes that visited Mars 30 years ago may have stumbled upon alien microbes on the red planet and inadvertently killed them, a scientist theorizes in a paper published Sunday. This was back in 76-77, the Viking space probe, and they were looking for the wrong kind of life. So they cooked some stuff up and... The guess is that if there was life there, and they think there may have been, that we killed it. Well, that's interesting. Speaking of life, I'm curious if this is going to be the next big right-wing story, or if they're just going to let this thing slide. And if so, I want to share my take on this with you, because I suspect that the right is going to try and turn this into something. Well, we'll see. We'll see. We may be way out ahead of the curve, or this thing may just slide on right by. But this is in the Associated Press today, Lindsay Tanner writing about it. The parents of a severely mentally and physically disabled child have stunted her growth to keep their little pillow angel a manageable and more portable size. In a case fraught with ethical questions, the bedridden 9-year-old girl had her uterus and breast tissue removed at a Seattle hospital and received large doses of hormones to halt her growth. She is now 4'5". Her parents say she would otherwise reach a normal 5'6". The case has captured attention nationwide and abroad via the internet, with some decrying the parents' actions as perverse and akin to eugenics. Some ethicists question the parents' claim that the drastic treatment will benefit their daughter and allow them to continue caring for her at home. So, I mean, here's the bottom line on this thing. What they've done is they're making sure that she's not going to, as she becomes an adult. Now, by the way, this is a little girl who was born with such severe brain damage. She's identified only as Ashley. Such severe brain damage that her condition has left her in an infant state, unable to sit up, roll over, hold a toy, or walk or talk. She's unable to do any of those things, and she will never get better. Now, and so what they did is they gave her hormone treatment. First of all, they removed her uterus and her breast so she would not become an adolescent. She would not go through adolescence and start menstruating and all that kind of stuff. And also in their family, they have a history of breast cancer. And so that would make, you know, reduce that. But the most controversial part of this is they gave her hormone treatments to keep her from becoming a full-size adult. And I'm on the side of that this was the right thing to do. And here's why. I have a relative who gave birth to a child, a close relative, who gave birth to a child with spina bifida. And the child, and this was over 20 years ago, the child is does not speak, you know, is probably mentally at the age of, I don't know, 5-6 months, something like that. You have to feed her, you know, with a spoon, and she wears a diaper and all that kind of stuff. And when she was young, it was, I don't want to say cute, but I mean, you know, she was a child as a child. But now in her 20s, she still cannot speak. She's still, and it's not because she can hear what you're saying. It's because, you know, she's mentally the age, mentally she's 5 or 6 months old. She's in a wheelchair. She can only sort of walk if you sort of walk her. And I've watched her parents who I know, and you know, I've, you know, as I said, one of them is one of my cousins, and I grew up with these folks. And you know, I've it's a whole different thing changing a diaper on somebody who weighs 80 pounds or 50 pounds and, you know, has the body of a 5 or 6 or 7 year old than it is changing the diaper on somebody who has the body of a 25 year old and weighs 140 pounds. And what these parents are suggesting is that by giving this child these hormone treatments, they're going to keep her small enough that as they get older and as she gets older, they will still be able to care for her. They will still be able to, you know, to meet her physical needs. And that she's less likely to get bed sores, because bed sores are the result of the pressure of your body against the bed. This is a child that can't roll over, can't sit up. And that as she becomes an adult, she's going to be smaller. She's going to be smaller and lighter and thus less likely to have problems with bed sores. And on the other side, you've got a bunch of ethicists and people who are saying, hey, wait a minute, these parents are playing God. This is absolutely wrong. How dare they stunt the treatment, the growth of this child? This, you know, this treatment is not for the child's benefit, but for the parents' benefit. The parents are saying, you know, by having her smaller, by having her spend her entire life the size of a 10-year-old, basically. She's 4'5" right now. She would typically be 5'6", they believe, based on, you know, siblings, I assume, or the size of her parents. She's bedridden. She's 9 years old. Is the right wing, are we going to see the modern-day equivalents of Bill Frist coming out on this thing? And if so, I'm just curious what your thoughts are on this. And should this become, you know, something that is replicated? Should this be the new way to deal with severely? We're talking. I'm not talking about somebody who can talk. I'm not talking about somebody who, you know. We're not talking about Down syndrome kids, for example. I've known a Down syndrome kid for 20 some odd years now. One of the kids at Solomon, Germany. He's a wonderful person. He's a person. You know. We have a relationship. But we're talking about somebody who is never even going to acquire language, never even going to have the ability to sit up on her own. Should this become a standard treatment? Or is that stepping over the line? Is this like genetically engineering? And, you know, is there some analogy there? 16 minutes past the hour. Back 21 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Program, the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no! No, not a chance. But Ashley is. And in an editorial in I'm looking for the title. Ah, here we are. In the October Archives of Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine, this editorial called the Ashley Treatment, what they refer to as the Ashley Treatment, ill-advised. A medical ethicist questioned how preventing normal growth could benefit the patient. Treatment that is not for a patient's direct benefit only seems wrong to me, the ethicist said. So are we going to have Bill Frist diagnosing this little girl? he's gone. Who's going to take his place? Is this going to be, you know, Bill O'Reilly's big thing tonight? Oh, the liberals, look at this. They're modifying children with hormones. Yes, they did. And I think that if it makes it possible for her parents to care, and somebody in the chat room said, well, why not just cut off her arm's length? No, come on. This is not about that. This is not about that. In the meantime, we've got people selling off body parts. We'll get to that in just a second. But first, some of your thoughts on this. Sharon in Lynnwood, Washington, listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Sharon.
Hi. I was just thinking, it sounds to me like it's out of love. They want to take care of their daughter.
That's what they're saying. They're saying that when she gets physically too large, they will have to put her in a care facility, particularly as they get older. And if they can keep her, 80, 90 pounds throughout her life rather than 150 pounds, that they'll be able to care for her and keep her at home.
And I think it should be between them and their doctor. I really do, because they're doing it out of love, I would think.
Yeah.
But what the
right wingers are going to be saying on this thing, in my prediction, is, oh, this is the beginning of euthanasia. This is the beginning of the, they're going to try and turn this into a variation on the debate about whether or not children with Down syndrome should be aborted, or whether or not if that somebody has low testosterone levels and you give them increased testosterone during pregnancy, you decrease the possibility of giving birth to a gay child. I mean, that's how they're going to spin this thing. Oh, we shouldn't do anything, is what they're going to say. But you're on my side with this.
Yeah, okay. I am.
I agree. Thank you, Sharon. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Okay. Sean in Sacramento, California. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to mention the fact that, yeah, I fully agree with you that it is weird how a lot of the progressive radio advertisers don't seem to be selling to progressive companies or progressive ideas or progressive products.
Oh, what we were talking about in the last hour, yeah.
Yeah, and I really, fully agree, too. Like, just some of the things I've noticed, like, we have two, progressive talk radio stations here in Sacramento.
Right.
And yet, you don't hear it. It seems to sort of echo the same talk radio advertisers that the right has.
Well, that's because these companies are doing these giant bulk buys, and then the radio station, the networks then pick those up, and it's just like I said, I think that stations need to have dedicated sales forces. Sean in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey,
hey
Sean.
I wanted to weigh in on the Ashley thing. As long as it keeps their kids from being institutionalized. Then, as a disabled person, I don't have a problem with it. Because that's the worst thing that you could do to anybody is to institutionalize them. And I think anything that you can do to keep that from happening, as long as it doesn't get out of hand,
yeah.
No pun intended,
yeah.
I don't have a problem with it at all.
So even if at the age of 20 she has the body of a 9-year-old, you think that that's a fine thing? Because that's what they're doing, essentially.
Yeah, I know. And as long as it's very closely watched and regulated and stuff doesn't, get blown out of proportion.
Yeah.
But, the right-wingers had their concerns, too, and I fully understand that.
Sure.
Any kind of modifying of the body when it comes to hormones or any of that can get a little scary, but I really don't have a problem with it. I really don't.
Yeah, euthanasia is a slippery slope. I mean, just, you know, the whole thing. And that's one of the conditions. I mean, I guess there are some folks who see, you know, shades of gray, and there are others who see everything in terms of black and white. And those who are seeing everything in black and white are criticizing these parents and criticizing them rather severely. In my opinion, wrongly, but nonetheless, criticizing them very severely for doing this, because they're concerned that it's establishing a precedent of some sort.
In some ways, but as long as this is a true agenda that they're doing it just for that one reason, then, you know, if it keeps them from being institutionalized,
yeah,
then fine. And, you know, you can bring it up to the right wingers as, you know, they don't have to spend their taxpayer money, you know, paying for somebody to take care of them in a nursing home.
That's true. That's a good point.
It costs about $3,000, $4,000 a month.
Yeah. Okay, good point. Sean, thank you very much. Always great to hear from you.
All right, you too, Tom.
Thank you for calling in. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be back right after this on the place where being progressive never felt so good. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman radio program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Drop by the Tom Hartman live chat room if you'd like. Just go to tomhartman.com and click live chat. It'll drop you right in there. Let's take a, before we get back to your phone calls and the rest of the news of the day, let's just take a quick look at what's going on with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And they're alive in the balance.
Security developments in Iraq as of 1200 hours Greenwich Mean Time on Monday, compiled by Reuters. Dateline Baghdad, the defense ministry said its forces killed 22 suspects on Sunday as an operation in a Sunni neighborhood where 27 bodies had been found by police on Saturday. The ministry had already reported killing an additional 30 people on the first day of the operation on Haifa Street. In Ramadi, a suicide truck bomber killed two policemen and wounded three more at a checkpoint in Ramadi, the capital of western Anbar province. In Baghdad, a U.S. soldier was killed on Sunday when his patrol came under small arms fire. In Tikrit, a U.S. soldier was killed during combat operations in the province of Salahaddin on Sunday. In Samarra, gunmen kidnapped a senior tribal chief in that province, seizing him from his car on the road north of town. He's the brother of the deputy governor of the province. In Baghdad, gunmen ambushed a bus carrying dozens of cleaners and other workers from the Shiite Sadr city district in Baghdad to the city's airport, killing at least 15 people and wounding 15 others. In Baghdad, a bomb planted under a car killed two people and wounded two others in the southern Zanafaria district in Baghdad. In Baghdad, a roadside bomb exploded near a bus carrying pilgrims and wounded three of them. In Baghdad, a roadside bomb targeting a police patrol killed a policeman and wounded two. And in Baghdad, Iraqi army troops killed 26 insurgents and wounded 43 others. And in Baghdad, gunmen killed six members of a Shiite family while they were packing their furniture to move from their neighborhood in the Dura district in southern Baghdad, an interior ministry source said. Meanwhile, Lieutenant General Raymond Odierno said that a combination of jobs, provincial elections, anti-militia legislation, and stronger Iraqi security forces will stop the nation's plunge toward all-out civil war. Lieutenant General Peter Chiarelli, his predecessor, spelled out the same approach before his departure 1 month ago. Notice the first word, jobs. Lieutenant General Raymond Odierno said that a combination of jobs, etc. Commander's statements came days before President Bush is to announce a new course for U.S. policy in Iraq, probably Wednesday, expected to include an escalation of between 9,000 and 30,000 U.S. troops an increase in civilian advisors to Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's government, and perhaps, and here's the kicker, $1 billion in new aid for reconstruction efforts. Now, you've got 34 million people there. If you put in $1 billion, that's 34 to 1,000. What is that? I can't do math that fast. How many dollars that is for everybody? But it's enough to hire some folks, you know, in a country where the average income is $500 a year. In the meantime, we were talking about Ashley's case, and at the same time, the BBC is reporting about the organ trade. You know, again, this gets back to, you know, where is there a slippery slope? I frankly don't think the Ashley case is a slippery slope at all. But this in Manchester, England, a Manchester youth has agreed to sell a number of his body parts for £90,000, according to an exclusive reported in the Sun newspaper. Undercover reporter Oliver Harvey met with Umar Mabul, 24, after the latter posted an ad on the Internet putting his body parts up for sale. By the end of the meeting, he had agreed to sell a kidney, a section of his liver, and was willing to sell one of his corneas. Why? He said, I want to buy a house for my family in Pakistan and start a business, a shop or something. A Guardian writer asks, is it time to consider setting up a legal market in body parts? That trade is illegal in the U.S. and the U.K., although it's not illegal in many other parts of the world. The Sun newspaper claims people are selling organs such as kidneys, parts of their liver, and the corneas from their eyes online to raise money. Also warned of the potential dangers involved for the donors. Oh, people are going over to China right now. They will execute a prisoner for you if you need a liver. Bang, they'll take somebody out who's got your blood type and find a crime and shoot them dead. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Mark in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Mark.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine, but I'll get better. What's up?
Sorry I missed you on Friday. I had been listening to you talking about reframing conversations, and I would like to reframe the conversation about this little girl and her parents.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of vilifying a pair of parents for trying to do what they think is in the best interest of their child, I would ask why, when we have the wealth that we have at our disposal, are we in a society, in a situation where it's a fearful thing for your child to have to fall into the hands of state care, where...
Well, that's a good one. Sean's point, that the last thing you want is to be in a group home or in an institutional setting.
Correct. Where you're worried about, well, if this ever happens to my child, maybe she'll be abused. So if we keep her from maturing, that might keep that from happening.
Yeah.
As someone who is both a healthcare worker and a parent of a special needs child myself, I've seen a lot of this. And I think that the real tragedy isn't that these parents made a difficult decision, but the real tragedy is that our wealthy society doesn't do what it needs to do to support these children and these families so that they can have assurance that, right. That, you know, I think about it all the time. What if I drop dead from a heart attack? What's going to happen to my son?
Yeah. And in Sweden,
right over the idea that he could end up in one of these homes.
Yeah, in Sweden, in fact, in most of the Scandinavian countries, and in many of the more well-developed countries, and I understand in Japan, although I haven't been there and seen it, but I have seen it in Norway. The old age homes, you know, the institutions for the elderly, are really, really nice. I mean, they put a lot of money into this, and the quality of care is very, very good, and it's free. It's absolutely free. For as long as you're alive. And yet here in the United States, I mean, people are terrified by the idea of going into these kind of institutions. Whether it's young people like my first cousin once removed who, you know, with spina bifida, who's so profoundly retarded, eventually, I mean, her parents are going to get old enough that she's going to need care, assuming that she outlives them. Very young people, or whether it's elderly people. You're absolutely right. Our system is just, you know, terribly and tragically broken. Mark, thanks for the call, and thanks for making that point. Diana, we should be talking about the context of a healthcare system that can't handle these things. Diana in Olympia, Washington.
Well,
hey, Diana.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Tom. I really enjoy your show, and actually Mike Malloy's show, too. They're my favorite things on the radio.
Mike's a good guy and an old friend.
Good. Hey, you know, I've been through this walk and this carrying thing. I walked the walk of having to help my mother for 8 years, and the last 2 years she's been in diapers, and I had the real pain of having to put her in a nursing home. And you cannot imagine how hard it is when you love somebody.
Mm.
And
yeah.
There's no replacement for hugs and kisses and care that a loved one can do. But she's been in there for 7 months, and I go there every other day. But I live 30 miles away, but I still mop the floor when I go there. I make sure her teeth are brushed. I change her diaper a lot of times because I worry they're not. She had bed sores, and I made sure
Ouch.
They. You know what I mean? I mean, this.
Yeah,
is,
I do, Diana,
this
and
is
I think that.
Family thing.
Yeah, and I think that Mark's point that we should have better institutional care in the United States, and we should do everything we can to support families, more hospice
right.
care. We should
but
have people.
But the cost.
Who,
the cost out of pocket is not $3,000 or $4,000 like that lady said previously. It's she pays private pay $64.79 a month.
That's,
and that's
nearly $7,000 a month.
Not including the doctor's care. Pardon?
Nearly $7,000 a month?
$64.79 a month. And then she pays for her own medication, and she pays, you know, for
yeah.
Medicare plus
See, her that's the real,
for her doctor.
Yeah, that's the real death tax, Diana, is when
it
you
is.
Get old and infirm, we have a system, a private for-care or for-profit health care system that makes sure the middle-class people have every single last penny taken from them before they die. That's the real death tax, not
and
the
it,
not the estate tax.
And it's ironic that somebody as wealthy as Senator Frist is up on his throne over there telling other people how to live.
Oh yeah, and he got wealthy by running all these private hospitals. I mean, this
yeah,
is incredible. Diana, thank you for your call and your comment. I appreciate it. Brian in Phoenix. Hey, Brian, we've got to take a break in just a few seconds. Quick point.
Okay. Hi, Tim. How's it going?
Good.
Hey, I want to talk about Tom about talking about the Ashley treatment.
Yes.
I think it's kind of really inappropriate for you to bring it up because you're a real educated man. I love listening to you and your psychic evaluations and speeches and stuff. But the whole idea that you bring up into attention in national media will just, like, fuel it, like, this Chevy...
I got this out of the national media, Brian. I'm not the one who's bringing it to the national media. I mean, it was in today's paper. It's an Associated Press story. And that's my point, is that the right wing is going to take a spin on this thing. And I think that our approach to it should be, A, that this is a private and family matter, and B, you know, I agree with the caller from Pittsburgh, we have to have better institutional care. 45 minutes past.
May you grow up to be righteous. May you grow up to be true. May you always know the truth and see the light surrounding you.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. A couple of notes I received here. For this from Sasha in Seattle. She says, for many years I worked in the field of assisting people with developmental disabilities. Because of the limited ability for these individuals to make informed choice, any decision that would fall into the realm of what the rest of us would make for ourselves have to be carefully considered by a group of professionals and family members, carefully weighing all aspects and framing them first as being least intrusive and restrictive of these people's human rights. She says anything as radical and restrictive as these rights as the procedures this girl went through would require careful consideration and probably the advice of lawyers versed in both human rights and medical disability issues. This is a good thing. I think that only framing it against the sensationalist Terry Schiavo case and how it was taken up by right-wing fundamentalist nutcases gives too narrow of a perspective to it, as none of us would probably volunteer to be kept in perpetual childhood physically. This child in question needs to have people strongly question this procedure and treatment plan. Society needs, in all caps, she says, needs this sort of dialogue in order that we continue to recognize the rights of the individual and reduce the likelihood of a return to the era of automatic sterilization of the disabled, including with people with epilepsy and those with very modestly compromised cognitive ability and other more extreme treatments and procedures. So please don't discount all dialogue that questions these sorts of things deeply and passionately. I don't mean to question it. I am just concerned that the right is going to demagogue this thing. I get another note from Angela here. on the East Coast. She says, I'm with you. I have a profoundly brain-damaged brother, mental age 6 months. My mother took care of him at home until he was 29, and she was 63. She could no longer lift him to diaper or wash him. He had to be institutionalized, which was a heartache for my mother for the rest of her life. Had he been 60 pounds instead of 140, she probably could have had him at home for the rest of his short life. He was very loved by all of us. He was our happy angel. We wouldn't have done anything to harm him. Love your show. No, thank you. 1-866-440-8466. Tom in West Mifflin, Pennsylvania. Hey, Tom.
Hi, Tom. Great seeing you in Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
Really appreciated your trip. Hey, several years ago, we took half a dozen profoundly retarded folks out of an institution in West Virginia, about a dozen, into two group homes. When we took them out, they had just been recovering from surgery to repair their spot where their gastric feeding tubes were inserted. And basically, while they were in the institution, they lived like oysters. People on a regular basis poured nutriment into their stomachs and on a regular basis came by and changed them. And they did this because they couldn't chew and swallow because there were choke hazards, because they hadn't been braced and their esophagi were twisted. Once we brought them into the group homes, the care had been done. We had the staff to work with them to get them to chew and swallow. Also, they had never smelled food cooking in the institution since the nutriment was brought over in a on a cart. We were able to work with them just by their sense of smell. Most of them were blind and deaf, in addition to being retarded and unable to walk. But that smell of food let us make some physical contact with them. So I applaud this family for taking this really courageous move to keep this child at home. She's clearly going to get better care with family that can lift her and move her around than she would by hiring staff or having her put in an institution.
Mm. Good point. Well said. Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. 1-866-440-8466. Jim in Pittsburgh. Hey, Jim.
Yes, thank you. I was there Friday and enjoyed your talk, and I think they ran out of books at Borders.
Yeah, they did.
That's amazing, and you're terrific. I just want to make one quick point. Whether you believe that life begins at inception or when the first breath is taken, whichever your philosophy is, you have to also admit that parenting then begins at that very same moment. And that parent is responsible for the future of that child, for the goodwill of that child, for the health of that child. So the parent should have primary say as to what happens to that child. And a lot of these people who have never seen or been experiencing any of these kinds of conditions should really shut up.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
Thank you,
Jim. Yeah, it's just so hard to imagine. Like I said, I saw my cousin's daughter go through this and grow up and still be in diapers. And it's, you just don't get it, how difficult it is to parent these kind of kids and adults until you actually see it happen. Anyhow, let's change the subject here. Joe in Lake Placid, New York. You wanted to talk about NAFTA. Hey, Joe.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine.
That's great. I just want to make some comments about NAFTA. Mm-hmm. I've just got my journal from our sheet metal union, and it's a great article on NAFTA. I'll just make it short. The Economic Policy Institute has followed NAFTA impact very closely. In 2001, they reported all 50 states and the District of Columbia having experienced a net loss of jobs under NAFTA, losing about 766,000 actual and potential jobs between 1993 and 2000. California lost 82,000 jobs, Tennessee and Georgia at least 20,000 each. Other states were Michigan, New York, Texas, and so forth and so on. With that being done, can you imagine that Congress has just passed CAFTA?
I know. It's by one vote, by the way. Had Republicans not been in charge, frankly, I don't think it would have passed.
Probably not.
But who knows? But I mean, this is the absolute insanity of it. And you don't have to, read the study from the Economic Policy Institute. Just look around. I mean, common sense would tell you. You know, that crazy old coot, Ross Perot, with the big ears and the funny charts and things that the media love to make fun of. He was right.
He was right.
He was spot on.
Listen to that sucking sound. That's going to be jobs.
There you go.
And it was, and it is, and sure enough.
Yeah. Joe, thanks a lot for the call.
You're very welcome, Tom.
Good to hear from you. And thanks for listening to us there. And, oh, man. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to hear from the real left. Carl Dixis, the national spokesman for the Revolutionary Communist Party, is going to be here. Plus Chris Hedges on his new book, American Fascists, the Christian Right, and the War on America. that and the news of the day and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group of, by, and for We the People tomorrow. In the meantime, remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Talk to you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.